Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM. This is Self-Defense 101 with DJ Daniel Sun. On this 25th anniversary of the assassination of Archbishop Oscar Romero, Free Radio Santa Cruz presents a historical overview of U.S. involvement in Central America. Stay tuned. Self-Defense 101 presents Sovereignty When It Suits Us, from anti-communism to anti-terrorism, from Guatemala City to Panama City. I begin with CIA agent Stockwell, John Stockwell, an ex-CIA station chief, and he's going to quickly summarize U.S. involvement in Central America, especially in the 80s.
It was in the mid-80s that I coined this phrase, the Third World War, because in my research I realized that we were not attacking the Soviet Union and the CIA's activities. We were attacking people in the Third World. And I'm going to just quickly, in the interest of time, just give you a little sense of what that means, this Third World War. Basically, it's the third, I believe, in terms of loss of life and human destruction, the third bloodiest war in all of history. They undertake to run operations in every corner of the globe. They also undertook the license of operating just totally above and beyond U.S. laws. They had a license, if you will, to kill, but also they took that to a license to smuggle drugs, a license to do all kinds of things to other people in other societies in violation of international law, our law, and every principle of nations working together for a healthier and more peaceful world. Meanwhile, again, they battled to convert the U.S. legal system in such a way that it would give them control of our society. Now, we have massive documentation of what they call the secret wars of the CIA. We don't have to guess or speculate. We had the Church Committee investigate them in 1975, gave us our first really in-depth, powerful look inside this structure. Senator Church said in the 14 years before he did his investigation that he found they had run 900 major operations and 3,000 minor operations. And if you extrapolate that over the whole period of the 40-odd years that we've had a CIA, you come up with 3,000 major operations and over 10,000 minor operations. Every one of them illegal, every one of them disruptive of the lives and societies of other peoples, and many of them bloody and gory beyond comprehension all.
Now, Stockwell's talking about military interventions, specifically the U.S. involvement in Central America. A little bit later in the show, we'll be talking about economic imperialism and intervention as we shift gears to what's going on these days, especially with CAFTA. But first, on this, again, 25th anniversary of the assassination of Oscar Romero, I want to tell you a little bit about Oscar Romero. I'll play some of his speeches in just a little bit, but first, for those of you who aren't familiar with his life and work, a little bit of background. Oscar Romero was born in Ciudad Barrios, a small town in El Salvador. Longing to be a priest, he left home at 14 as his horse picked its way to San Miguel, 7 hours away, where he could begin preparing himself for his vocation. Ordained in Rome in 1942, he was appointed in 1967 Secretary General of the National Bishops' Conference. In the 25 years of his priesthood in Vatican II, with its plea for renewal, he met troubles with the hierarchy and basically he wasn't impressed with what he found in Rome. He supported the arrangement whereby the church kept the masses credulous and docile, while the aristocracy exploited them and the military enforced it all. Now, coffee had been planted in El Salvador in 1828, and international demand soon found private interests commandeering vast tracts of arable land while expelling subsistence farmers and indigenous people. By 1920, the land-owning class comprised 14 families. Dislocated peasants were now either rural serfs or urban wretched, in any case, trying to live on black beans and tortillas. One half of 1% of the population owned 90% of the country's wealth. In 1932, 30,000 people died in the first uprising. Indigenous people were executed in clumps of 60. The Te Deum was sung in the cathedral in gratitude for the suppression of communism. In no time, El Salvador was known as yet another security state, a totalitarian arrangement that suspended human rights and slew international enemies at will. supporting a policy of, quote, peace at any price. Romero, now editor of the Archdiocesan, magazine Orientacion, contradicted the previous editor who had cried out against social injustice. Romero focused on alcoholism, drug addiction, and pornography. There then occurred the event whose aftershocks are still reverberating through much of the world, the Council on Latin American Bishops in Medellin, Colombia. In 1968, Jesuits had declared their option for the poor and had articulated a theology that voiced their vision. They believed their theology to arise from confidence in the apostles' witness that the kingdom of God has come and needs to be lent visibility. In 1975, the National Guard raided Tres Calles, a village in Romero's diocese. By now, he was the Bishop of Santiago de Maria. The early morning attack hacked people apart with machetes as it rampaged from house to house, ostensibly searching for concealed weapons. The event catalyzed Romero. At the funeral for the victims, Romero's sermon condemned the violation of human rights. Privately, he wrote the president of El Salvador, naively thinking that a major clergyman's objection would carry any weight. His turn accelerated. Plainly, the church was at a crucial point in the history of its relationship to the Salvadoran people. Would it help them move past an oppressive feudalism or retrench, thereby strengthening the hand of the oppressor? When Romero was promoted to Archbishop of San Salvador, the capital city, the ruling alliance intensified its opposition. Six priests were arrested and deported to Guatemala. One of them remarked that the church finally was where it was supposed to be, with the people, surrounded by the wolves. Romero's first task as Archbishop was grim. He had to bury dozens whom soldiers had machine-gunned when 50,000 protesters demonstrated against rigged elections. By now, Romero had turned all the way around the corner, summonizing priests to his residence. He required no further evidence or argumentation. He knew what the gospel required of church leaders in the face of the people's misery. All priests were to afford sanctuary to those threatened by government hounds. Immediately, the hound sent a message to Archbishop Romero. As Rutilio Grande, a Jesuit friend who had struggled to implement reforms in the Vatican, was gunned down in his jeep together with an old man and a 16-year-old boy. Undeterred, Romero prayed publicly at length beside his friend's remains and then buried all three corpses without first securing government permission, a criminal offense. Next, he did the unthinkable. He excommunicated the murderers, and in a dramatic gesture, he canceled all services the following Sunday, except for a single mass in front of the cathedral, conducted outdoors before 100,000 people. When he went to Rome to explain himself, the Pope replied, "Courage." Right-wing groups were leafleting the nation with, quote, "Be a patriot, kill a priest." Reprisals intensified. In one village, anyone found possessing a Bible or hymn book was arrested, later to be shot or dismembered. Four foreign Jesuits were tortured, their ravaged bodies dumped in neighboring Guatemala. Thousands of people disappeared without trace. In all of this, Romero never backed down. Romero insisted that he had not warped the gospel into a program of social dismantling, let alone malicious social chaos. He criticized priests who wanted to reduce the gospel to political protest without remainder. He deplored protesters' violence, even as he admitted they were victims of long-standing institutional violence. Knowing himself to be on the government's hit list, he went to the hills to prepare himself for his final confrontation. He telephoned his farewell message to Excelsior, Mexico's premier newspaper, insisting that, like the Good Shepherd, a pastor must give his life for those he loves. Romero was shot while conducting mass at the funeral of a friend's mother. His assassin escaped in the hubbub. That's kind of interesting, and has never been found. I'll talk more about his assassins shortly. 250,000 thronged the cathedral square for his funeral, and a bomb exploded at his funeral. Panic-stricken people stampeded, and 40 died. In the next 2 years, 35,000 Salvadorans perished. 15% of the population was driven into exile, and 2,000 simply disappeared. So in the face of incredible repression, Archbishop Romero struggled against his position in the church to return the church to, as it said earlier, what its role should be. The church should be with the people. As a liberation theologist, he found repression within the ranks of the Catholic Church, as well as in the government which he fought. And for a quick summary of more U.S. involvement in this. We're going to hear from Rosa Panate. I interviewed Rosa last year, actually almost exactly 1 year ago. It was as it was the first anniversary of the current phase of the bombing and war on Iraq and Iraq's people. Rosa spoke with me about U.S. involvement in El Salvador, her native country.
I'm very sure that Jeb Bush was in early in January in El Salvador, showing the Arena Party how to disenfranchise people in El Salvador and how to steal once more, steal the elections in El Salvador so that they can continue their dynasty or their domination in El Salvador. Roger Noriega was in El Salvador also, and he was trying to sell CAFTA and NAFTA, and he was also intimidating the people in El Salvador, practically telling them to vote for Tony Saca, who is from the Arena Party, and also he was telling people to vote for the candidate that is in line with the principles of the United States. In other words, let's continue the United States domination in this country, because that is what it is. If ALCA or the FTAA goes through in Latin America, El Salvador practically is going to disappear, because United States is like a vacuum, and El Salvador is going to be absorbed. Right now, El Salvador, unofficially, we are a colony, United States. If Arena Party wins again the elections, we are going to be officially a colony of the United States.
Extensively, we manipulated and organized the overthrow of functioning constitutional democracies in other countries. We organized secret armies and directed them to fight in just about every continent in the world. We encouraged ethnic minorities to rise up and fight, people like the Mosquito Indians in Nicaragua, the Kurds in the Middle East, the Hmongs in Southeast Asia. And of course, we have organized and we still do and fund death squads in countries around the world, like the Treasury Police in El Salvador, which are responsible for most of the killing of the 50,000 people just in the 80s, and there were 70,000 before that.
Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM. You're listening to Self-Defense 101 with DJ Danielson. We're going to hear audio right now from the School of the Americas, School of Assassins, a film made about the School of the Americas, again involving U.S. involvement in El Salvador.
What you saw in the Iran-Contra hearings was the exposure of the beginnings of a national security state which believes it has the right to override the Constitution of the United States in the name of security.
I think that there was a substantial shadow government trying to run foreign affairs for the United States.
In any other country, it would have been called a coup. And they seem to have gotten away with it.
These are modern-day pirates, these guys. They have escaped, essentially, the control of national governments, but they're available for use by national governments. Sometimes they move under color of, and defend themselves as advancing U.S. national interests in this. But I think that's very secondary with these guys. They're out to make a buck.
I did do it. I am not, as I said in my statement, at all ashamed of any of the things that I did. I was given a mission, and I tried to carry it out.
The Iran-Contra hearings, convened in May 1987 by a special joint committee of the United States Congress to investigate the sale of U.S. weapons to Iran and the illegal diversion of money to the Contras. Often, the official explanation seemed inadequate and contradictory.
Our government has a firm policy not to capitulate to terrorist demands, that no concessions policy remains in force. In spite of the wildly speculative and false stories about arms for hostages and alleged ransom payments, we did not, repeat, did not trade weapons or anything else for hostages, nor will we.
Despite Reagan's denials, investigations soon revealed that arms had been traded for hostages held in the Mideast.
A few months ago, I told the American people I did not trade arms for hostages. My heart and my best intentions still tell me that's true, but the facts and the evidence tell me it is not.
Lies.
It was further revealed that the arms to Iran had been severely marked up. Some of the profits had been illegally diverted to support the Contras, a guerrilla force organized by the CIA fighting the Nicaraguan government. The Reagan administration had a major scandal on its hands. Use of U.S. government money for supporting the overthrow of the Nicaraguan government was specifically prohibited when Congress enacted the Boland Amendment in 1984. Even though it remained in effect until 1986, millions of dollars in profits from Iranian arms sales were secretly diverted to the Contras during this period through contacts with middlemen such as Moniker Gobanifar. Did these hearings uncover the full story behind the Contragate scandal? Or was it merely an attempt to keep the real truth hidden from public view? Peter Dale Scott, professor at the University of California at Berkeley, has conducted extensive research on covert action and CIA activities. The results are detailed in his book, The Iran-Contra Connection.
I think the real issue was that both the administration and the majority of the people in the committees were frightened that the real scandals, the drug scandals, for example, would really threaten any future conduct of covert operations on the scale that they had been handled in the past. And so they were trying very deliberately to limit the damage. This was damage control.
And so they were pulling their punches on all the major questions and issues of what really happened in this thing, what the CIA's role was. Anytime they got into anything that was really sensitive about exactly that, exactly what the CIA's role was and exactly what laws were broken and when, they went into secret session.
There was a lot of talk during the hearings about covert operations, national security, the necessity of secrecy in conducting foreign policy. But some experts claim that covert action does not work in the interest of the U.S. national security, nor does it create a more stable world.
To think of the democratic governments that have been overthrown in the last 30 years by military coups is almost like giving a capsule history of CIA covert operations in the last 30 years. I mean, there was the overthrow of Prime Minister Mossadegh in Iran in 1953. There was the overthrow of Arbenz in Guatemala in 1954. There was the overthrow of the Brazilian government in 1964. There was the overthrow of the Ghana government in 1966. A lot of the governments I've just mentioned got into trouble with the international oil companies because they tried to assert their national prerogatives over their own resources. Time after time, the CIA has come in on behalf of those multinational companies.
Ahora hacer un análisis, pero no quiero abusar de su tiempo, de lo que han significado estos meses de un nuevo gobierno que precisamente quería sacarnos de estos ambientes horrorosos. Y si lo que se pretende es decapitar la organización del pueblo y estorbar el proceso que el pueblo quiere, no puede progresar otro proceso. Sin las raíces en el pueblo, ningún gobierno puede tener eficacia, mucho menos cuando quiere implantarlo a fuerza de sangre y de dolor. Yo quisiera hacer un llamamiento de manera especial a los hombres del ejército y en concreto a las bases de la Guardia Nacional, de la policía, de los cuarteles. Hermanos, son de nuestro mismo pueblo. Matan a sus mismos hermanos campesinos. Y ante una orden de matar que dé un hombre, debe de prevalecer la ley de Dios que dice no matar. Ningún soldado está obligado a obedecer una orden contra la ley de Dios. Una ley inmoral, nadie tiene que cumplirla. Ya es tiempo de que recuperen su conciencia y que obedezcan antes a su conciencia que a la orden del pecado. La Iglesia, defensora de los derechos de Dios, de la ley de Dios, de la dignidad humana, de la persona, no puede quedarse callada ante tanta abominación. Queremos que el gobierno tome en serio que de nada sirven las reformas si van teñidas con tanta sangre. En nombre de Dios, pues, y en nombre de este sufrido pueblo, cuyos lamentos suben hasta el cielo cada día más tumultuosos, les suplico, les ruego, les ordeno, en nombre de Dios, cese la represión. La Iglesia predica su liberación tal como la hemos estudiado hoy en la Sagrada Biblia. Una liberación que tiene por encima de todo el respeto a la dignidad de la persona. La salvación del bien común del pueblo y la trascendencia que mira ante todo a Dios y solo de Dios deriva su esperanza y su fuerza. Vamos a proclamar ahora pues nuestro credo en esta verdad.
I come from a world of books, and there is much to learn in their pages, but I have much else to learn. There is ferment and division alive in our land. Certain priests express the most radical ideas glibly, but none of us can pretend to know all the answers and demand that others implement them. We in the church must keep to the center watchfully, in the traditional way, but seeking justice. I'd like to make an appeal in a special way to the men in the army. Brothers, each one of you is one of us. We are the same people. The farmers and peasants that you kill are your own brothers and sisters. When you hear the words of a man telling you to kill, think instead in the words of God, "Thou shalt not kill." No soldier is obliged to obey an order contrary to the law of God. In his name, and in the name of our tormented people who have suffered so much and whose laments cry out to heaven, I implore you, I beg you, I order you, stop the repression!
Free Radio Santa Cruz, these are the words of Oscar Romero 25 years ago today, shot down. During his, so we'll hear a little bit about the history here. During his last years in office, President Jimmy Carter and his policy towards El Salvador is one of encouraging gradual democratization. I might argue with that, but I'll just keep reading instead. The administration openly criticized human rights violations there and briefly cut military aid. Expectations were raised among the members of the middle class that with the U.S. help, El Salvador could become a democratic state. The rise of the Nicaraguan Sandinistas in 1979, however, led to a, quote, reassessment of this policy. Carter was attacked by conservatives in the U.S. for losing Nicaragua, and his policies shifted from an emphasis on democratization towards simply maintaining the Salvadoran army's strength in the face of a challenge by insurgents. In December of 1980, after he had already been defeated in his bid for re-election by Ronald Reagan, Carter suspended military assistance to El Salvador following the murder of four American church women. Military aid was resumed on January 14, 1981, when the Salvadoran regime teetered on the brink of collapse during the FMLN's final offensive. The new Republican administration soon declared El Salvador a principal battleground in the war against what it described as expansionist communism. Ronald Reagan, in a speech to the National Association of Manufacturers, sketched his views on the strategic importance of El Salvador and Central America. Central America, he said, is simply too close, and the strategic stakes are too high for us to ignore the danger of government seizing power there with ideological and military ties to the Soviet Union. Soviet military theorists want to destroy our capacity to resupply Western Europe in case of an emergency. They want to tie down our attention and forces on our own southern border. Reagan released massive amounts of military aid to El Salvador, helped create the Contras, an anti-Sandinista guerrilla front, and built up the Honduran army as a firewall against the further spread of revolution in the region. Guatemala's genocidal army was given covert support in its war against its indigenous population, and secret military bases were set up in Pacific Costa Rica to support the war effort against Nicaragua. These secret bases in Costa Rica were so secret that there's a surf spot on the northern coast of Costa Rica called Ollie's Point because Oliver North set up an airfield there. And it's so secret that the Costa Ricans have called that place Ollie's Point for a couple of decades now. Harvard professor John Coatsworth, in his study of U.S. policies in Central America, wrote that, quote, no U.S. government has ever devoted as much of its own political capital and the nation's resources to Central America as did the Reagan administration. None had such profoundly traumatic effects on the region. None left office with such little control over events in the region. In El Salvador, the Reagan administration consistently rejected a negotiated settlement between the FMLN and the government. Although ostensibly trying to build a centrist majority around the Christian Democratic regime of José Napoleón Duarte, Reagan's insistence that the war be decided on the battlefield and not at the negotiating table ensured that support for the political center would wane. For many Salvadorans, to support the PDC was to support war without end in El Salvador and U.S. interventionism. After 1989, the Bush administration turned away from its predecessor's policies. According to Coatsworth, Bush sought to restore Central America to its previous position as an area of secondary concern in U.S. foreign policy. After the embarrassment of the 1989 FMLN offensive and the murder of six Jesuits by the Salvadoran army, the Bush administration increasingly backed efforts by the UN to broker a negotiated settlement of that conflict. But that wasn't even the one I was looking for, you see. The one I was looking for is the UN Truth Commission excerpts on Romero's murder. We just heard a couple of lines from a final speech delivered by Romero and then a translation by Raul Julia in the film Romero. And so I want to talk briefly about the murder 25 years ago today. The murder of Salvadoran Archbishop Oscar Romero was investigated by the UN Truth Commission in 1992, a little fucking late. The following excerpts are from the commission's final report. On Monday, 24th of March, 1980, the Archbishop of San Salvador, Monsignor Oscar Amulfo Romero, was celebrating Mass in the chapel of the Hospital de la Divina Providencia when he was killed by a professional assassin who fired a single 22 or 223 caliber bullet from a red four-door Volkswagen vehicle. The bullet hit its mark, causing the Archbishop's death from severe bleeding. Romero had become a well-known critic of violence and injustice, and as such was perceived in right-wing civilian and military circles as a dangerous enemy. His sermons deeply irritated these circles because they included human rights violations, and in a sermon on the 17th of February, 1980, he expressed his opposition to U.S. military aid to El Salvador, pointing out that, quote, neither the government junta nor the Christian Democrats govern this country. Political power is in the hands of the armed forces, which are unscrupulous in their use of this power. They only know how to repress the people and defend the interests of the Salvadoran oligarchy. That same month, he received death threats and therefore decided that his colleagues should no longer accompany him when he went out so as not to expose themselves to unnecessary risks. On Monday, the 10th of March, an attaché case was found near the high altar behind the pulpit, which the police found had contained a bomb that had failed to go off. The investigation to determine who was responsible for Romero's assassination was not only inefficient but also highly controversial and plagued by political motivation. The National Police went to the chapel of the hospital to gather evidence. They did not do this properly, however, since they failed to collect material evidence of the crime at the scene. The judge for the Fourth Criminal Court gave instructions for the Salvadoran Polyclinic to perform an autopsy on the body. Following an attempt to assassinate him at his home on the 27th of March, Judge Ramirez Amaya tendered his resignation and left the country. On the 7th of May, 1980, in a rail on the San Luis estate, 12 active and retired military personnel and 12 civilians, including Major Roberto de Oposición, soon to found the Arena Party, who we'll hear about shortly, who had gathered there were arrested and formally accused of plotting to overthrow the government by means of a coup d'etat. Documents seized during the raid included a list of accusations made against Monsignor Oscar Romero, a diary belonging to former Captain Alvaro Rafael Saravia. The Saravia diary contained various important pieces of information concerning the assassination of Romero. It referred to purchases and deliveries of large quantities of arms and ammunition, some of which were the type used in the assassination. None of the documents seized at San Luis estate were made available to the judge investigating the assassination, and it was only years later that the court gained access to a copy of this diary. In November 1987, Armando Antonio Garay revealed that on the 24th of March 1980, Saravia had ordered him to drive a red Volkswagen to the hospital. He had parked outside the chapel. His passenger, a bearded stranger, had ordered him to crouch down and pretend to be repairing something. He had heard a shot, turned around, and seen the individual holding a gun with both hands pointed toward the right side of the rear window of the vehicle. He smelt gunpowder, and at that moment the bearded man had calmly told him, "Drive away, take it easy," and they drove off. Garay alleged that he had driven the individual to former Captain Saravia, to whom the stranger had said, "Mission accomplished." 3 days later, Garay had driven Saravia to a house where former Major de Obusión was, and Saravia had said in front of de Obusión, "We've already done what we planned about killing Monsignor Amulfo Romero." The commission finds the following. This is the UN Truth Commission. There is full evidence that former Major Roberto de Obusión gave the order to assassinate the Archbishop and gave precise instructions to members of his security service acting as a death squad to organize and supervise the assassination. Now, following the war in El Salvador, following the peace agreements that were brokered on the battlefield and then at the table, the two sides in this war, the FMLN, which was a a group that came together of five different armed guerrilla movements that decided to work together against the government. And the Arena Party that was, again, shortly founded after by someone who I just explained was responsible for the assassination of Archbishop Romero, decided to become the two major parties in El Salvador and fight it out at the ballot rather than on the battlefield. And so for a little bit more information about the Arena Party, again, we'll go to Rosa Panate.
The Arena Party. Can you tell us about their background?
Well, his main opponent is Arena. And the candidate for the Arena Party is Tony Saca. Tony Saca has not even qualifications to be a president. His background is a sport broadcaster, so that doesn't qualify him to be a president. And on top of that, anyone who is associated with the Arena Party has his hands tinted with blood.
Okay, mi nombre es Rosa Peñate. Pertenezco al FMLN. People in El Salvador are tired of the government of Arena. And that is because since Arena took power in El Salvador, people are much more impoverished. There is hungry there. There are lack of jobs. There are no education practically. The education, most of the people are educated up to sixth grade. That is if they are lucky. Mainly what they are producing is making sure that they are producing maquila workers. They're not preparing professionals so that they can compete in different arenas and different and more advanced industry or technology or science.
Free Radio Santa Cruz, that was Rosa Panate 1 year ago in San Francisco. She works with the FMLN, the major political party on the left in El Salvador, and the Arena Party, the party of the businessmen and assassins of Oscar Romero on the right. Interestingly enough, currently in El Salvador, the party is, the president is Arena, but most of the governors and most of the city governments are controlled by the FMLN. The election that she was discussing, Tony Saca versus the FMLN candidate, was a really interesting one, and I wish I had more information about it. It was a year ago, and I'm starting to forget a little bit because I tend to do that. But Tony Saca is a wealthy sports broadcaster, as Rosa was saying, and her candidate, his opponent from the FMLN was a longtime union activist and social justice advocate in El Salvador who had worked, who's basically, I think he's 75 or 80. He's a very old man who had worked very hard throughout his life to bring peace to El Salvador. And in the contest between the two, some really strange parallels came out because they're actually both Palestinians. They were both born in the same neighborhood in Palestine and immigrated to Central America and to El Salvador. And, you know, had run these really, really parallel lives, but on both sides of the conflict. They have a lot in common. But one has been consistently working for capitalist U.S. intervention, and one has consistently been working for sovereignty and freedom and peace. Strangely enough, at the ballot, under U.S. elections observers can only tell you so much because they're from the U.S., but Saca claimed a narrow victory, and the FMLN barely conceded. There were widespread allegations of voter fraud. I was actually there on election day in El Salvador, in an area controlled by the Arena Party, and going into both campaign offices on that day was really interesting because the Arena office was filled with local business owners, very confident, very white, very well dressed folk. And the FMLN office was busy, filled with youth running about, people of color, indigenous people, very dark skinned people, and they had handwritten signs and they were organizing things on shoestrings with makeshift just about everything to get their word out. But that place was packed. The Arena office was just a bunch of businessmen sitting around waiting for their buddies to count the votes. And it became quite obvious what was really going on at the polls. I heard stories about people that were just being bought off, you know, on their way in, essentially, to vote Arena. And so that's what we had. So the effect of this kind of thing is we have politicians that readily concede to U.S. demands and full cooperation with the U.S. And in that sense, we come in the conversation to CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement. And so I want to switch gears a little bit from focusing on El Salvador to kind of a larger picture. CAFTA is currently working its way through Central American governments as well as the U.S. government. All nations involved, so this would be Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, and Panama, are involved in the treaty, which is an extension of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. And as I heard this morning on a lovely free radio station, Fox and Chrétien and Bush are currently meeting in Texas to discuss how NAFTA's going. And they all seem to give it a big thumbs up and want to continue to work together on economic issues and military issues and security issues, et cetera. Now, CAFTA, though, has had quite a week. In Guatemala, massive protests threatened to shut down the government and shut down the capital. But despite thousands and thousands in the streets of Guatemala City, of Guate, the legislature passed. They ratified CAFTA. Other Central American nations have not done this yet. All of the nations involved have signed, but Guatemala has just ratified it. Costa Rica is still holding out. But protesters in Guatemala are facing brutal repression during these protests. And so, again, as we end up with politicians in power in these countries, things like CAFTA just sail right on through. So we're going to hear the FMLN's take on CAFTA right now. Again, Rosa Panate.
The FMLN opposes CAFTA, and they have been opposing since the very beginning. And the only reason CAFTA is to the situation where it is right now, almost on the last stages of the negotiation. That is because the negotiations are being carried out across the closed doors. But the FMLN is going to revisit all the privatizations that have been taking place in El Salvador. They are going to study everything that has been privatized.
My understanding is that the bulk or a large part of the privatizations have been in healthcare and in hospitals.
Healthcare has been tried to be privatized, but HMOs and PPOs have been introduced in our culture, and our people are not used to that. And what this has done is increase the cost of healthcare. Doctors right now are all associated in PPOs and HMOs. And visiting a doctor is just incredibly expensive. The medicines are incredibly expensive. People cannot have access to health care. They cannot afford health care. Health care in El Salvador is very scarce, very expensive, and doctors are very, very scarce. Poor people cannot have access to health.
Thank you for your time.
One more time.
Poor people cannot have access to health.
Yeah, that's right. So CAFTA is NAFTA extended to Central America. All the same issues human and labor rights organizations have with NAFTA and the FTAA are present in CAFTA, including secrecy instead of transparency. No formal public input or oversight is built into these negotiations. Corporate domination over democracy. At the expense of democracy and the people's right to self-rule, CAFTA would likely give corporations powers to object to barriers to free trade, including laws people enact for their own protection. For example, NAFTA established the right for companies to sue governments over public interest laws that may limit their profit. This right has been employed 27 times by companies since 1994. I'm reading from stopcafta.org, by the way, in case you're wondering what my biased opinion is. Increased inequality. A minority of rich companies and wealthy stockholders will benefit from reduced costs, but the poor will get poorer, and more people will move into poverty. Workers will get lower pay and lose their jobs while shouldering higher costs of living as more services are privatized. Again, why do we oppose to CAFTA? Increased inequality. disappearing public services, corporate domination over democracy, and secrecy instead of transparency. Resources such as education, healthcare, energy, and water utilities owned by everyone in the community will likely become owned by corporations. This could put essential public services out of the hands of many people. For example, when Bolivia privatized its water utility, water rates increased 200%, leading to riots that resulted in 6 deaths. Reduced labor rights. Labor laws such as those that protect workers' safety can also be challenged, and the race to the bottom for pay will likely hurt workers in all countries involved in CAFTA. A negative agricultural impact. Increased corporate domination of farms and possible devastation of family farms and farmers in the U.S. and Central America as well. Increased environmental destruction. Environmental laws are just one type of barriers to free trade that can be gutted. This decreases costs to companies but increases costs to local communities who suffer more health problems as a result of pollution. So, again, CAFTA is a free trade agreement that includes the U.S., El Salvador, Nicaragua, Guatemala, Honduras, and Costa Rica. The Dominican Republic may also be added to the group. Belize is at this point not included. Negotiations for CAFTA were completed in December and January of last year. So, again, CAFTA must now be approved in the national assemblies of each of the participating countries. And this has been an ongoing battle and struggle. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, and I'm talking about U.S. involvement in El Salvador. Thank you for tuning in. We're going to continue talking about U.S. involvement in Latin America and Central America, so stay tuned for that. On the topic, here's a little bit of information about someone whose name should be familiar.
Negroponte worked with Henry Kissinger in the National Security Council during the Vietnam War and later served as U.S. ambassador to Honduras, Mexico, and the Philippines. President Bush tapped Negroponte to serve as his ambassador to the U.N. and most recently as the first American ambassador to post-invasion Iraq. Negroponte's most controversial tenure was in Honduras, where from 1981 to 1985 he was a key player in coordinating the Reagan administration's clandestine and illegal attacks on the government of Nicaragua via the Contra Army. Negroponte stands accused of being complicit in or turning a blind eye to massive human rights abuses committed by Honduran military officials supported by the CIA. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst with the National Security Archive, who discusses Negroponte's past and why he feels it's important for the Senate to closely examine this nominee's attitude towards human rights that could further undermine America's moral authority.
There are really three strikes against Negroponte in his tenure, his very controversial tenure as ambassador to Honduras. First of all, he essentially served as proconsul. He was a throwback to the era of gunboat diplomacy when the United States attachés would essentially run these little countries in Central America. The first issue about him is that he was essentially managerially in charge of the Contra War in an extraordinary way for a diplomat. We have declassified documents, including memos to President Ronald Reagan, saying that Negroponte, as ambassador, was suggesting 3,000 new AK-47s for the leading Contra force, for example, and would the president approve of this recommendation? We have the declassified document with Ronald Reagan's two little initials RR in the yes box. That's just an extraordinary thing for an ambassador to be involved in, you know, micromanaging the amount of weapons going to a paramilitary force, attempting to overthrow a government with which the United States actually had still diplomatic relations. The second issue was that after the U.S. Congress decided, because of people like your listeners, that the Contra War should be shut down and cut all aid to the Contras in Honduras, Negroponte was part of a team of people that included Oliver North and others, and frankly, I should say, the father of the current President of the United States, who was then Vice President of first George Bush, participated with his team in circumventing congressional restrictions, the congressional cutoff on Contra aid, and Negroponte was instrumental in the bridge of communications between President Reagan and Vice President George Bush and the senior Honduran generals to bribe them, to offer them quid pro quos so that they would continue and even, in fact, actually step up their support for the Contra War, which was more needed than ever now that the CIA was supposed to get out of the picture and U.S. official U.S. funding was no longer there. And of course, this kind of segment of the Contra War was funded illegally by funds from the sale of arms to Iran, then flowing in buying arms that then were illegally shipped to the Contras in Honduras. And the final issue that has haunted him, his career, and is the one that I think people are raising the most right now, is that he suppressed as ambassador full reporting of the atrocities that were being committed by the Honduran military, particularly its elite special operations unit called Battalion 316, which was working very closely with the CIA and which was clearly involved in death squad activity and in murdering suspected leftists, anybody who was thought to be supportive of Nicaragua or against the military government of Honduras. Negroponte may well have misled the U.S. Congress in terms of his knowledge of human rights abuses in Honduras and the degree of which he had intelligence as ambassador on this and tried to distort that information getting back to Washington. And you don't want somebody in this most important role of intelligence czar who has a background of distorting the truth and misleading the Congress of the United States. Congress needs an honest broker to be the person that shares with it the information on our intelligence needs and the threats against the United States of America. Two, you don't want somebody who has a track record of turning his back on human rights abuses involved with a situation where we're already in a very controversial and dire strait with the atrocities that are going on, the torture of detainees in various secret detention camps around the world.
That was Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst with the National Security Archive.
And then the system brought...
Oh, I almost messed that one up. So there's a little more information about John Negroponte, our former ambassador to Iraq who inhabited Saddam's palace and called it the U.S. Embassy. And then now he's what's his job now? He's in charge of intelligence, right?
The brand new created position by the 9/11 Commission's recommendations. He's the new like head of national security information. So he's going to be conducting more clandestine intelligence operations here domestically now because he proved himself so valuable in Honduras and Iraq over the past years.
What a great guy.
You know, the family takes care of each other.
So in terms of those protests in Guatemala, I was trying to give you some information and a website was locking me out here. But so last week in Guatemala, there were huge protests. The people have been organizing against CAFTA for months and months and years and years. CAFTA and Puen Puebla, Panama and all of these, the FTAA, there's obviously widespread opposition to some of these plans. And it really came to a breaking point last week in Guatemala. Two people were killed and many injured, hundreds injured, as violence broke out during protests in Guatemala on Tuesday, the 15th of March, when President Oscar Berger ratified the Central American Free Trade Agreement, or CAFTA. The deaths in Huehuetenango follow 2 days of violence as people across Guatemala joined the biggest demonstrations ever seen in the country. Protesters argue that CAFTA will make Central American countries more dependent on the U.S. As the anti-CAFTA rally ended, police and soldiers launched violent attacks on the crowd using batons and tear gas. Two protesters were fatally shot. Police surrounded the headquarters of Guatemala's trade unions under orders to capture trade union leaders. The violence followed similar protests in neighboring Honduras, when anti-CAFTA campaigners stormed Congress when the government signed CAFTA on March 4th, a month ahead of schedule. Honduras was the second country to sign up to the agreement following El Salvador, which signed in December of 2004, and now Guatemala is the third. Panama, Costa Rica, and Nicaragua are still under negotiation. Trinidad Sanchez, director of CONAI, a Christian aid partner in Honduras, said, "We have raised our voice to denounce the danger that comes with this free trade agreement. This is going to increase unemployment, it is going to increase the crisis of food security in the country, and it is going to make health and education less accessible for the people of Honduras. And this is not only for Honduras, but for the whole of Central America." CAFTA follows the North American Free Trade Agreement signed in 1996 between the Canada, U.S., and Mexico, the Canada. Yeah. As part of a coalition of organizations campaigning against CAFTA, CONAI has logged the impact of NAFTA on Mexico. It is argued that overall, NAFTA has increased inequality and reduced incomes for the vast majority of Mexicano workers. Conai argues that free trade with the U.S. is going to bring misery to the poor of Central America, further misery, I should say, who will be forced to compete in an unfair market. Agriculture will be the worst hit, and peasant farmers are at risk of not being able to grow and sell beans and corn, Central America's staple diet. As the world gears up for the Global Week of Action Against Unfair Trade, Central America will continue pressing against CAFTA. Trinidad Sanchez was one was at the World Social Forum in Delhi in 2004 when the idea of a week of solidarity and campaigning was born. He said, quote, "We have been opposing the CAFTA treaty for many years. What we wanted from the international campaign was the linking of movements. We had not predicted, though, that the Global Week of Action would coincide with the signing of the treaty in Central America. It was a good coincidence." So the president of Guatemala there is, as the article mentioned, this is from Indie Media, Oscar Berger. Now, it was a year and a half or so ago that Berger was elected. And as I mentioned, the Salvadoran election, I want to mention a little bit about what was happening in Guatemala, because we hear that these countries are eagerly in support of these treaties and these agreements with the U.S. But a little bit, just a little bit of anything other than ignorance will tell you that the people of these countries are vehemently opposed, openly opposed. And as you just heard, the largest rallies, the largest protests ever in Guatemala were against CAFTA. But the president, Oscar Berger, was elected, maybe, by the people in an election in which his opponent was named Rios Montt. Rios Montt was a military leader in the 40-year Guatemalan Civil War, convicted of war crimes, widespread repression. And, you know, if you have anything to do with the Guatemalan military in the 80s, I don't know if you have any kind of legitimate credibility, and I don't know if you should be doing anything besides rotting behind bars. But he came from house arrest, basically, and decided that he would, despite rules to the contrary, rules actually barring him from running, he decided that he would run for president in a very dirty campaign with a whole lot of dirty money. Eventually, the Guatemalans elected as a compromise, and those of you who support compromises in this country might take heed. He was elected president of Guatemala, Oscar Berger instead, a white U.S.-educated neoliberal puppet who promptly passed CAFTA. So, you know, this is the kind of political system that gives rise to leaders who support U.S. intervention, as Costa Rica has consistently done, who support U.S. Financial interests, as the ambassador to Honduras has done, and who support general U.S. hegemony and military strength in the region at the expense of the sovereignty of their own people.
As and, every government has done.
And that's Sandino on the mic
Except
here.
Cuba.
Except Cuba. Well,
more or less. All things considering.